all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Michelle Paradis. He is a historian, an author, a law professor, and he has a new book out called The Light of Battle, really about Dwight Eisenhower, about Ike, D-Day, the birth of American superpower. It's an interesting and timely read. Michelle, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's one of those things where always good to remind us of our own history, but tell us why this book now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think for me, the real draw was Eisenhower, because we have this received image of Eisenhower, almost as everybody's grandfather who, loved to go golfing. And that, I think, does short service to someone who is utterly fascinating. Here you have probably one of the most powerful generals in all of human history, who was raised by religious pacifists in, rural Kansas. Here you have someone who, wanted to be a general from the time he was a little boy, but, convinced that he may be forced out of the army at West Point, decided his fallback plan would go being a gaucho in Argentina. You have someone, and I discovered in the writing of the book, who is warned in advance of D-Day that the Nazis are not only developing nuclear weapons, but there's reason to believe they might even try and use them. And he's then told that not only can he not do anything about this information, he can't tell anyone really either. And so he focuses on the things he can control, which in his mind is the weather. And so you have this person who is as, interesting and, complicated and as conflicted as America itself in many ways. And so he is just, I think, a deeply underappreciated source of study. And I think that's particularly important, particularly at a time like now, where I think we also need to understand how real leaders use power. One of the, I think, downsides of his, fairly benign Saturday Evening Post image that we've inherited is that it leads you to misunderstand how it is that a, farm boy from the middle of Kansas goes on to be the first president to be called the leader of the free world. And studying him closely, I think not only does him the service that he deserves, but I think it also tells us what we should be looking for in leaders, because he's someone who did learn to master the art of power under the most difficult circumstances, and amidst some of the greatest personalities and rivals of the 20th century, whether it's de Gaulle or Churchill or Roosevelt. And that, to me, is especially this time when the United States is very divided, when the world seems incredibly uncertain, and we're in a political election year ourselves, you know, thinking about what real leadership is always valuable. And I think Eisenhower just provides an invaluable window into someone who really masters the art of leadership and the responsible use of power.
Well, that's one of the reasons, or the reason one should read history, is to learn lessons that we can apply in our world today. One of those things I got out of reading The Light of Battle was, and you mentioned his intersection with all these, you know, historic figures now, Roosevelt, Marshall, Churchill, Monty, Patton, Omar Bradley, Jimmy Doolittle, Hap Arnold, Wild Bill Donovan. I mean, he intersects with all of these folks and really demonstrates a skill in relationships. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, you know, Eisenhower never serves in combat prior to World War II. He rises up through the army, you know, as what was derisively called back then a desk general. And yet he goes on to be trusted to command, you know, the most powerful military force ever assembled in the most complicated military operation ever conceived. And how does he do that? I think a big part of that is he is liked, to be, you know, to use a cliche, Ike is liked. And he's not liked in a superficial way. He's liked because he understands, I think, two very important things. One is, and, you know, this is, you know, I think something that outside the context of the military is people, is important for people to hear, is he understands the virtue, not just of leadership, but of followership. Because throughout his career, he essentially is the trusted mentee to a number of very important mentors in his life, to include Douglas MacArthur, to include a guy I write about at length in the book, Fox Connor, and to include General Marshall himself. And that art of followership is valuable, not just because it serves his ambition to, you know, rise ever higher in the ranks by being a trusted subordinate. He understands the value of genuine service. And that, in turn, I think, is the second thing that allowed so many people to not only just like Eisenhower in a superficial way, but to genuinely trust him. And that is, he was never as much of an ego as he did have, to be sure, right? You don't get to that position in the world without having a strong sense of self-confidence, if nothing else. He always understood that it was never about him. That he was always about the mission, and he would always make sure, you know, sometimes just through his good old, you know, hokey, you know, Kansas sort of geniality, but really in the, you know, acceptance of blame and the distribution of credit for when things went well, he always kept in mind that if anyone around him ever believed for a moment that he was in it for himself, that he was in it for, you know, what we would call today clout, that not only would people not trust him, the only people who would ever help him achieve, you know, the amazing things he achieves as the Supreme Allied Commander and then as the President of the United States are going to be yes men and toadies. And almost the worst thing you can have when you have real responsibility on your shoulders is a bunch of people around you who are unwilling to tell you the unvarnished truth. And so that aspect of Eisenhower, his commitment to something greater than himself, his understanding, I think, in deep in his bones, whether it's he's coaching a football team or leading the Allied invasion of Normandy, that we can always and will always be able to accomplish more together than any one person can accomplish. And that the only way to collectively achieve what seems like it might be impossible, is if everyone understands the goal and understands that he, as the leader, is 100% committed to them and the goal, not to his grandiosity, not to himself. And that kind of skill is a leadership skill, to be sure, but it's an interpersonal skill, because sense of his integrity is really what drew people to him.
And it's really that those personal qualities, as well as being, you know, smart and articulate and being able to listen to different sides and make decisions, that led him to ultimately be in command of Overlord and the D-Day invasion. We're at the 80th anniversary of D-Day, where 4,414 men died on the beaches, including 2,500 Americans. That, let's remember, that's 400,000 people who died in World War II, as compared to, say, 58,000 in Vietnam and 2,500 in Afghanistan. But it's those personal qualities of his that he had, because not everybody wanted him to run the show, did they?
No, quite the opposite. You know, the British were never fully convinced of the value of Operation Overlord. And for the first 2 years of the war, you know, the British were very much the senior partner of the Atlantic Alliance. And they thought the invasion was too risky. And in some ways, they were right about that, even though we ultimately did pull it off. But it also, the British understood that there were essentially long-term opportunities to be gained for the British Empire in this war, right? This was neither Britain's first, and I'm sure at the time they did not think it was going to be its last war either. And so for the first 2 years of the war, the Allies largely pursued British strategy, which was to expand the Allied control over North Africa, then Italy, and the British had broader designs on the Eastern Mediterranean, not the least to cut off the Soviets from having their own sphere of influence in the Eastern Mediterranean if and when Nazi Germany ultimately fell. And so when the decision to finally launch D-Day is made in November of 1943, it's one of the most acrimonious fights that, you know, you could almost imagine at some of these high-level summits, right? We stuffy, prepared, formal affairs, and, you know, the records we have from it show that George Marshall and Sir Alan Brooke, his counterpart on the British Chief of Staff, you know, nearly broke out into a fist fight at one point over the future direction of the war. And so Eisenhower, when, you know, he's given this job, it's a very sensitive position. It's a position where he's now stationed in London, launching a mission that the British government, stationed also in London, is at best unenthusiastic about. And so Eisenhower has to have the both wisdom, humility, and frankly political cunning to get the British as on board, and in many respects fully on board with this operation. And that's, in a sense, one of the hardest parts of his job, is holding the alliance together and keeping the British invested in the cross-channel invasion. So that's a great success.
And that's one of those things you learn from reading history, is that you realize sometimes you're given a job, A, nobody wanted you to have, maybe B, you didn't want to have. It isn't going to be easy, but you still have to soldier on. And obviously, we can all relate to that in our life. And adversity is part of that. You write about the adversity that Ike faces through these years, whether it's the press or politicians, or you mentioned Alan Brooke, General Brooke. Adversity is just part of it. Isn't that part of what builds Ike and highlights his ability to hold it all together?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, I mean, I'm sure this is slightly controversial in some quarters, but I think he was the indispensable man, certainly when it came to the D-Day operation. I don't know that there was a single person alive in a position to be given the job who could have done everything that it required to have the victory that it did. And because chief among that was patience, right, was an ability to put himself and what people thought of him second. And that partly is, you know, everything that I talked about before, which is just, you know, humility and the power that one can wield if one is humble about the power at one's disposal. But it's also, you know, cunning, right? Like Eisenhower, you know, like we should, one of the things that I never, that I sort of, you know, hope this book offers somewhat of a corrective for, is this idea of Eisenhower as sort of a just go along, get along nice guy, right? He, when he needs to be, and pardon my French, can be a ruthless son of a bitch. And he understands that if he's, you know, prancing around, jutting his chin out, you know, trying to show that he's boss, not only is that going to, you know, not win him any friends, it's going to be deeply counterproductive. And so he's someone who can bide his time, be patient, you know, take the bad press that, you know, onto himself as a way of ensuring that people in a way underestimate him. And one of the most important things he does, it's very subtle, but I think it's in some sense crucial to his success, is when he goes to visit British soldiers during inspection tours, he wears a British officer's coat to signal to everyone that he does not see himself as an American commander. He sees himself as an Allied commander. And even on D-Day himself, in his statement to Europe, in his announcement of the invasion to the European people, he doesn't mention the United States once. He talks about how the United Nations have come to liberate Europe. And it's a... it is a genuine point. It's humility. He genuinely does understand and believe in the value of what we would now call multilateralism. But it's, you know, a crucial political move to make in that kind of situation too, because America is, you know, largely unknown around the world at this time, and objectively dangerous. Right? We are suddenly not only the world's largest economy, but one of the world's largest militaries. We have, you know, the ability to project power all over the world. And whether it's in Great Britain or France or China or North Africa, you name it, you know, the entire world at that point is having to make a judgment about whether or not the United States should succeed, or should they resist the rise of this new superpower on the world.
And there was no, even the term superpower is, in, if you will, invented because of this.
It is. It's 1944 is the term is first invented. And honestly, I give Dwight Eisenhower a lot of personal credit for understanding that in that moment, when this new idea of not an empire, but a superpower is coming onto the world stage, that superpower needed to be different than the great powers of old. And an important way of showing that difference was showing that this American superpower was committed to working as a team, working for the liberation of people, working for democracy, human rights, ultimately decolonization, in a way that I don't know that any other American figure of the time, maybe save President Roosevelt, could have credibly sold to the world the way that Dwight Eisenhower could.
Yeah. You mentioned his patience, and I'll just touch on this briefly, because you write about General Patton's slap of the soldier in Sicily and all the fallout from that. And as I'm reading that, I thought, Ike's got incredible patience here to realize the value of Patton and not overreact to this. I mean, many of us would have said, just fire the guy, you know? Patience was one of those virtues. But he's also deeply human, and the pressures get to him. And you write about that a little bit, and you talk about Kay Summersby, the Irish Catholic, you know, British service woman who's his chauffeur all over Europe. So those pressures got to him in a human way, didn't they?
Oh, for sure. He ends up, by the time D-Day comes around, he's smoking three packs a day. He develops a sty in his eye. His ear starts ringing. He acquires a cold right before he's appointed to be the Supreme Allied Commander that he basically never shakes, certainly up through D-Day. And that, to me, you know, one of the ways I wrote this book that I think differs not only from a lot of books about D-Day, but even a lot of biographies of Eisenhower, rather than go to the, you know, received stories and the memoirs and other histories and biographies of him, I went back to the primary sources, and particularly for this period, I pulled out his day planner, which I was able to locate in the archives, and went day by day with him just to see what he really cared about, what worried him, who bothered him, who liked him, and what he dealt with on a day-to-day basis. And I just came away from that, like, my blood pressure was going up as I was reading all of this, because just the amount of stress this man just had, the amount of pressure leading up to an operation D-Day that his own chief of staff, Walter Bedell Smith, projects only a few weeks in advance of it, estimates that is going to, you know, has a 50-50 chance of success. And that means it has a 50-50 chance of failure. And for Eisenhower to be dealing with all of this conflict on every side, and to be the center of that, and to be the one, you know, the one steady post in the storm, just took something superhuman in terms of patience.
One of the things, I want to get to this before we run out of time, you write about, and I categorize these as sort of ethical issues that he as commander-in-chief had to deal with all these other pressures going on, and there are two of them in particular I want you to talk about. There were a number of racist charges against black soldiers in Britain that he had to deal with, and second, the use of white phosphorus, and particularly both of those you don't read much about. So I thought you probably pulled these out of going back to his day planner and saying, what did he have to deal with every day? Talk about these two issues.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I would never have known any of that had it not been, you know, for really just trying to be with him on a fly, like a fly on the wall day to day. And the one thing that jumped out at me was how much the problem of civil rights just dragged everything that he was attempting to do. Because here you have, you know, by the time D-Day launches, 1.5 million young Americans being imported into the British Isle. About 12% of them are black. But at this time in our history, the army is segregated. And the British see American segregation, really, you know, American sort of separate but equal de jure segregation, as morally repugnant and almost inexplicable. They can't understand why the United States sort of has this sort of violent racism at the very same time it's preaching democracy, equality, and human rights around the world. And it's a constant point of friction in the British Isles where black service members are being mistreated by superiors. They're not necessarily being given the same access to public recreation facility. The whole question of interracial relationships between black soldiers and white British women is not only provocative to a lot of Americans who have sort of retrograde views on race at the time, but Eisenhower is quite worried that the British are, you know, might not respond to this, you know, with complete equanimity. I mean, it's a fire keg, and he understands that. That complicates his life, not just because it's a really important, you know, ethical issue that he has to deal with, but it's a diplomatic issue, because at the very same time, you know, all of these controversies about American sort of race relations being imported into the British Isles are flaring up. He's also having to negotiate with Britain's Foreign Office about the use of ports, about the, you know, sending of men abroad, about the, you know, access of American soldiers to, you know, various facilities, the use of water in Great Britain. These are, you know, lots of delicate diplomatic negotiations that he's having to conduct. At the same time, he's attempting to explain, you know, the great American shame of, you know, segregation. And then at the same time, the British are coming to him and saying, as you mentioned, you know, we can't support the use of white phosphorus in the D-Day landings, which at that point, the U.S. Army had started regularly using, not only for its screening effects, but as an anti-personnel weapon. And the British Foreign Office lawyers, apologies as a lawyer for those who find this, the involvement of lawyers in these wartime decisions, you know, frustrating. But lawyers in the Foreign Office determined that this would be a violation of Britain's commitments under the Chemical Weapons Convention, which it was a party to, but the United States was not at the time, as well as even the Geneva Conventions. And the Foreign Office basically says, look, we can't allow, you know, His Majesty's Army to be implicated in war crimes. And so Eisenhower has to essentially negotiate a settlement on whether and how they can use white phosphorus in the literal days before D-Day. And so these diplomatic stresses that he's operating under, which touch, you know, issues of grand strategy like empire, but touch really profound and difficult questions of ethics, like the use of chemical weapons, arguably, or American race relations, just, you know, show the complexity of the job he has.
Yeah.
And frankly, just as a concluding thought, show why he was, you know, so well equipped to become president. It was almost an easier job than the one he had in
London.
It
probably was, yeah. We're talking to Michel Paradis, author, historian, lawyer, who wrote and is now out in publication, The Light of Battle. It's a great update, I'll say, to Eisenhower, D-Day, and the birth of American superpower. Michelle and I were talking earlier. He quotes, and I have an out-of-print copy of Dwight D. Eisenhower's personal account of World War II called Crusade in Europe on my shelf, which is also a great read. and probably one that nobody could write today because it's way too candid for a politician. But he didn't view himself as a politician, did he?
Not quite yet. He was keeping his ears to the ground a little bit. He writes that in 1946, 1947. But he is not interested in running for president in 1948, even though Harry Truman more or less offers him the presidency then. And but he hasn't fully shut the door. As humble as Eisenhower is, he's also a man who knows his place in history.
Absolutely,
for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. Great read. Thank you for spending some time today, Michelle, with Veterans Radio to talk about the light of battle and shed some insight into General Eisenhower and the whole D-Day as we are here celebrating or recognizing the 80th anniversary of D-Day.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a really interesting discussion.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows
by visiting us at veteransradio.org. That's veteransradio.org.
And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, VA Ann Arbor Health Care System, the Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Presscorn Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. We appreciate all your support. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsor level, and continue to support keeping Veterans Radio on the air. And until next time, you are dismissed.